You're listening to Popstar Conversations, taking you inside with your favorite musical artists.
Chuck and I are sitting here with Chrissy Hynde of The Pretenders. Chrissy, thanks for joining us.
It's good to have you here.
This record, Stockholm, it's your first international record in 6 years. What have you been up to?
I don't spend all of my time just doing music, you know? I have other shit I do, you know, when I'm not doing music. I'm not very ambitious, and I'm not, like, the most motivated. What I love is being on the road. I love being on the road, and I love making records. So actually, in the last 6 years, I did make another album, that which was another collaboration that only came out in America. So that took a couple of years, and I toured America with that. I toured Australia with Blondie at one point. That was fun because, you know, that was in kind of different territories. And then I made this record. So, well, and actually, since the last Pretenders album, which took 11 days to make, this took 2 years because I had to keep going back and forth to Stockholm. You know, we toured a lot after the last Pretenders album, too. We did a lot of touring. So it's actually been pretty full up with work.
When you're doing a solo record, how is it different from doing a Pretenders record?
This is called a solo album, but it's actually more of a collaboration than anything I've ever worked on. You know, wrote with all the songs with Björn Yttling and a few with Jocke Åhlund. And I've never done that before for a whole album. I mean, generally with the Pretenders, I bring the lion's share or all of the songs into the band. But they wouldn't leave Stockholm and work with me and come and get in a band with me. I begged them, but, you know, they have other bands and they do other things. So I was just left on my own, and that's why it's got my name on it. It's embarrassing because I like being in a band. I don't like being out front. But, you know, it's, there you go.
But in the past, weren't you opposed to a solo career?
And I always said never. You know, I think it's a kind of a marketing tool now as well. Not something I would have thought I'd say 30 years ago, but really no one cares anymore, and that's the way it's gone. And my sort of new management team, that's another thing. I've got a whole new organization and a new, so, you know, I had a lot of business to attend to. And they all thought this was a good way to kind of revamp things a little bit. And I'm happy to take advice, and I'm a team player, so I like to do what everyone wants me to do, you know, as long as I can do what I want to do in the studio and on stage. The rest of it's, you know, use me already, you know, so.
How did you end up collaborating with Björn?
Peter, John, and Björn, yeah, and then Jocke is in another band. Björn is in Peter, John, and Björn, which I didn't know who they were until about 5 subsequent visits, and then I finally Googled him. And realized what band he was in. And then his friend Jocke Åhlund is in a band called The Caesars and The Teddy Bears. So when Björn was trying to pawn me off on someone, because I think he was trying to get rid of me, he said, go write with Jocke for a while, which we did. And then, you know, it took a lot to convince Björn to do the whole thing, just because he was very busy.
Wasn't Peter producing Licky Lee in between?
He was doing that. He was doing Peter, John, and Björn. And, you know, he's got a family, all that kind of thing. Whereas I'm just hanging around waiting. So, you know, I took about, it must have been about 20 visits to get to go there, work for 2 or 3 days and come back. But I don't mind because I don't mind traveling and being on my own. So I'm used to it.
Well, with all that traveling you were doing, it must have really added to the, you know, how long it took to make this record.
Yeah. I mean, I went there about every, maybe once a month, once every 6 weeks I'd go. And, you know, I had my own stuff going on in the meantime, and so did they. So I always had to wait till they had some time and I had some time. So it just took, but I didn't mind because I was glad to hang out and go to Stockholm. And I was there in the winter when it was dark all the time. And then I was there in the summer when it never gets dark and it's a beautiful city and I could hang out and explore a bit. So I was happy. I mean, it's one of the beautiful cities in the world. And I love cities, so I love exploring them and wandering around. You know, I went through a cathedral one day on the way to go see Jocke, and I saw these little bracelets on the way out. They sell candles and stuff. And I bought these little bracelets, and I said, hey, look what I got us. Jocke's all tattooed, and he likes jewelry and stuff. He's not like Björn. So I had my little bracelet on, and I put his little bracelet on him, and I got one for Björn. You know, I was determined that we were going to be a band. And Jocke looked, and he goes, what are these Russian icons? I said, I don't know, but that's what the name of our band is. So I called us the Russian Icons for a year, but I couldn't force them to leave Stockholm. So now it's just me again.
generally speaking, the Swedish people, they're quite tranquil.
They're very stoic, which has worked out well, because once I started seeing how it worked, not Jaki so much, but with Bjorn, I did things on this record which I never would have dreamt of doing on my own. Like any Neil Young, I wouldn't have called Neil, even though I know him, I wouldn't have called him because he's Neil Young. I just wouldn't have done that if it was really a solo album. But I was kind of fucking with Bjorn's head, and because we had this one song that we kept referring to as a Neil Young song, one day I said, well, of course I could always get Neil Young on. And I was totally fucking with him, just to see if I could get a reaction out of this stoic Swede. And then three more visits went by, and I would refer to the Neil Young song, and I thought, actually, I could get Neil Young on this song, and that is a good idea. So that's, you know, so I called him and we did it. Same with McEnroe. I was just trying to get a rise out of Bjorn when I realized he liked tennis. So I said, had McEnroe come down to our studio when he was doing a sort of tennis match. Otherwise, I wouldn't have thought of it. And I'm glad I thought of it, because I've known John for 30 years and he's been on stage with the Pretenders, and, you know, we're great friends.
In all the years that you've been performing, did you ever have to cancel a performance?
Sure. And well, myself, I think I've canceled maybe 5 gigs in my career. Once when a doctor said I'd have a miscarriage. Once when a doctor said both of my eardrums were going to explode if I got on stage. So there's always been, you know, I'm not a crybaby. I will get on that stage and I'm always on time. But there comes a point when modifications have to be made. You know, so get it while you can if you're 30, but, you know, get ready to put the cork in the bottle. And especially with the smoking, you know, it's all these addictions are psychological anyway. They're easy to walk away from, but it takes about 30 years of thinking about it before you can, you know, that's the mind fuck of it all.
Okay, let's get back to this record. Were you after a danceable rock record with this one?
I have always been after a danceable rock record, and I don't think some of the Pretenders records really, really made it on that level. That's why I love the Black Keys stuff. You know, it's got that fairground. They really pay attention to rhythms, and that's where I think the starting point should be. And that's how it was on this record. I actually didn't have an agenda in mind. The reason I kept working with Bjorn is because that's how he did it. He started with a good rhythm, and then he'd have little top line melody or maybe a couple words, and I'd say, he'd put it on his little laptop. I'd press the bar and listen to 8 bars. That's as much information as I'd get in one go. And then I'd say, okay, come back down in a half an hour. And he'd leave me in the basement, and when he'd come back, I usually was ready to do the vocal.
And there's a song in this record, Dark Sunglasses, and it's about the British upper class. How did you come up with that?
That was Bjorn's title. And I said to him, oh, come on. I didn't say anything. But what I thought was, you can't write a song called Black Dark Sunglasses. It's such a cliche. And in fact, I was wrong, because it's a great title for a song. But that's the fun thing about collaboration, is the other collaborator that I had a lot of fun with, and the only other person, well, no, I've written lyrics with a couple of people now, but was Tom Kelly and Billy Steinberg. Because Billy Steinberg would have a very sentimental, sensitive song, and that made me feel sadistic, so I would really kind of fuck with it. And that's how the thing worked, is we would kind of mess with each other. And we wrote some of my favorite songs together, actually. So working with someone else, even if you've just met them 10 minutes ago, can really trigger things off. And with songs, that's what you need. You need a trigger, and if they have a title, even better, because that puts you in a direction. If you're sitting alone in a room with a guitar for years, the way I've done, just trying to be inspired or trying to express yourself, it's just too, sometimes it's too lonely. It's depressing. You're tortured while you're trying to write the song sometimes. Not always, but it's not always a pleasure. And, you know, what's the point?
Was that song referring to the royal family?
No, it's got nothing to do with anyone in the royal family. I think it was a bit of a comment on the class system, the way it exists in England, which is breaking down and changing a lot. And, you know, it's not for the first time, it is dissolving somewhat. And I think people will miss it when it's gone, because society always has some sort of hierarchy. And the way it's going now, where it's becoming more third world, where there's the rich are stinking rich, and the people who have nothing really have nothing, like impoverished, the middle classes kind of keep the thing afloat. And it's, you know, it's not going that way at the moment. But anyway, this song more, it was more a reference to the English class system and, you know, sort of middle, the middle classes are the ones that are social climbers and try to better themselves. The working class and the upper classes, they just stay where they are, and they don't want to move because they like where they are, traditionally.
Even though rock music has always been the expression of the middle class.
Traditionally, it was a tool for working class kids to express themselves. Like many of the arts were a vehicle for people who, again, this isn't, I'm actually American, so I was in the States for the first 20 years, and then I came over here and it took me another 30 years to start to understand how this class system works. I find it very amusing myself because I'm not part of it, so I have no feelings about it, really. It doesn't trigger any emotions in me at all. But I'm an observer, and I can see the way it's going, and I can see the way it's gone in the States, too, and I think people will always find their own hierarchy, and there's always a sense of superiority with some people. Whether they are superior or not is something else. But in largely, it's based on money these days. But the cultures generally come from the bottom up more, or maybe up at the higher echelons of society, they're paying for it, but it's the people at the bottom that are doing the creative work traditionally. But now, for the first time, a lot of more privileged kids are making music, and certainly in films. But I mean, to have a grudge against the upper classes is just as lame as having a, you know, putting someone down for being black or gay, or I mean, what? It's just, you know, that's just inexcusable, and it's indefensible. But that's what all these working class kids were doing in the punk days. You know, what they were really pissed off about is they didn't have the money. So, you know, this idea that it was social justice. Someone like Strummer, who was working class, he did have something to say about social injustice. But the ones who were just working class, they just wanted to get the money. That's the way it goes. Because oppressed people usually are more interested in getting the spoils of the oppressor than fighting the oppressor. That's what I've learned.
Throughout the years, you have become an expert at writing love songs, haven't you?
Well, I'm not an expert on writing them. I'm more of an expert on listening to them, though. I've been an audience. I've written my fair share, I suppose. If anything, I wouldn't say I'm an expert writing love songs. I'm an expert listening to them. But if I were to say what constitutes being able to write one, it's disappointment, longing, being hurt, being crushed, destroyed, you know, it's all the negative parts of it that makes you want to write a love song. Not that many people write love songs about feeling good. And if they do, it's a blag. They're just trying to get over their feelings. Like Some Guys Have All the Luck. It sounds like an up, fun song. The song, Some Guys Have All, that song. When you hear the chorus, you think, you know, it's a sing-along, good-feeling karaoke number. But when you listen to the lyrics, it's about a guy who's sitting on a bus looking at other couples, and he's sitting there alone, and he's not a very happy person. That's the point of view that most love songs are probably written from. You were always on my mind, but I never told you.
When it comes to songwriting, when writing a certain type of song, for example, is it a type of therapy for you?
I don't know. I've never been in therapy. So yes, it is. It's a kind of therapy. But you're also trying to lift your spirit and say something. That's the difference, I suppose, between writing songs for other people to sing and writing songs that you're singing yourself. I differentiate. I've never written songs thinking I'm going to send them off to someone else to sing. I've only written songs, even my collaborations, songs that I think I'm going to sing. So I'm expressing my own feelings. It's very common now for people to sit and like knock out songs and farm them out to other artists. And that doesn't in any way mean that they're not great songs. I mean, that's how all those guys in the Brill Building did it. And, you know, many great songs have come out of that. Hal David and Burt Bacharach, they tried to sing them themselves, but, you know, it wasn't very successful.
I have to mention, though, when it comes to your personal life, you're very private.
Yeah, well, you know what? I'm not even going to talk about it. I'm not going to talk about my private details, you know, because you know, I'm not a very proud person, and I'm not proud of much in my life, but one thing I'm proud of is that people don't have to know too much about me, and that makes me feel good, because the artists that I've loved in my lifetime, like let's say authors, Graham Greene, a great novelist, I read 10 of his novels, and I never had any idea what he looked like or anything about him. I knew he was English just because of his name, but that's how I like it. I think art, you're offering whatever it is that you're offering, if it's a record, if it's a book. These days, you have to give your whole, you know, even if you have a book, you go on a book tour, you have to expose yourself. And then people are judging if they want to buy your book by your personality. And it really has gone way far in the wrong direction from my personal taste. I mean, most people like that. I don't like it. And I don't want to get to, because I don't want to live in a high security prison. You know, I don't want to have to stop being able to hang out and do what I do and get on a bus. I mean, who wants to live that way?
You know, being so private, I would assume that you're really not that interested in social media.
Well, I'm not that involved in it. I send a blog. I have a Facebook page. I've never gone on it myself, and I've never gone on anyone's Facebook page. I've been told not to by people that I know who say, don't even start doing that. And I've seen the faces of other people that are on it, and I don't like the looks on their faces. I'm just not interested, to be honest. I'm just not interested. And I hear so many negative things from people who have complaints about it, being in touch with people they don't want to be in touch with. And I think there's what I've been told is there's a kind of false sense of how people present themselves. They present themselves in the light that they want to be seen in. And someone said something to me once that I thought was true, and that was that you never really know what you look like when you look in the mirror. And I think that's true. You know, you don't know how other people see you, because you look in the mirror at yourself with however you look at yourself, but that's not how other people see you. And I think that's probably what this social networking, you present the face that you want to see in the mirror, but you're not really seeing the real, you're not presenting yourself as you would at a bus stop with a stranger, because you sort of doctor it and, you know, make sure that you look the way you want to look. So anyway, I mean, I just don't have enough time for it. I'm not even judging it.
You got to tell us, how was your experience touring with Debbie Harry?
I really enjoyed doing those shows with her, and I was always so thrilled if she would come out and we'd walk around the shops together and stuff. And she was cooler than I was. Like, I'd be just about to buy something, and she'd say, why don't you just think about it for a while? And I'd be like, oh, yeah, you're right. And I'd put it back on the rack, and we'd walk out, and in 10 minutes, I didn't want it anymore. And she's smarter than me.
On another note, how long have you been a vegetarian?
Since the age of 17, I've been vegetarian, and I reckon that without a doubt, that got me through all the rest of the bullshit I was doing.
It must be difficult being a vegetarian with all the traveling that you do.
You really just don't need very much. That's the truth. People are obsessed. I mean, you know, if I hear one more person that say to me, oh, do you just eat, you're only eating carbs. And in fact, every time I sit down for a meal in a restaurant, which is often, that's the first question. So, you know, they want to talk about what I eat. And I'm like, God, can we just shut up? Can we just eat? I always have to qualify everything because I'm the only vegetarian or the only vegan. So, you know, and I get all this stuff about carbs and do you do this and do you do that? You know what? Fuck it. I just do what I want to do. Just leave me alone and I'll leave you alone and I'll leave the animals alone and you can do what you want to do with them. But if you do it in front of me, you're going to have to go through me.
Chrissy, I got to ask you a question before we go. You moved to London in the early 70s. What was it like being a part of that music scene that was happening over there?
Oh, I was more than fascinated. It was my whole life. It was me. That was everything to me. And then by the time I got to London and moved around and really started thinking I'd like to get in a band, and I spent a few years trying to do that, going from London to Paris to Cleveland, back to Paris, and then back here, and then the punk thing was happening, and then I could see up until then, although I would have liked to have been in a band and play guitar, I felt like being a girl was kind of like not the thing. I was too shy to get in a band with guys. And that punk scene, the deal was that nobody, first of all, nobody could play. So that was no longer a problem. And being a woman, or the whole thing was about non-discrimination. So whatever you did, you could do it and no one was going to make a comment.
Chrissy, thank you very, very much for coming on the show.
You too. Nice talking to you.
Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you again for listening to Popstar Conversations. Be sure to click the subscribe button below and hit the red bell so that you'll be notified of our next exclusive interview. Thank you again for listening.
Thank you for listening to Popstar Conversations. Please join us again for another conversation with your favorite musical artist.